We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking with Hunter Lovins, someone who is quite well known for writing about speaking about sustainable development. She's founder and president of Natural Capitalism Incorporated and Natural Capitalism Solutions. She was founding professor at Presidio Graduate School's MBA in Sustainable Management program. She was co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute, and she is the co-author of a book that we'll be talking about. The title of the book is Climate Capitalism, the subtitle Capitalism in the Age of Climate Change. Hill and Wang is the publisher, and her co-author on the book is Boyd Cohen. And the book really makes this argument. She says, and she has this rather surprising take on the subject of global climate change. She says that if what you're really interested in is making money, seeing the economy really be healthy and strong and robust, it really doesn't matter whether you think global climate change is a problem or not. If what you're interested in is making money, you and you're in business, you will behave as if it is a problem. That's really the argument that the book makes. She argues that working toward greater efficiency and energy use and embracing new technologies is not only good for the planet, it is also good for the bottom line. So you can find more of her thinking in the book. But, of course, here this morning, you'd like to call in, make comments, ask questions, be a part of the conversation, you certainly are welcome to do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us email, you can do that too. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here you want to join the conversation, you can do that. And Hunter Lovins, hello.
Howdy.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on your show.
And I think that is, as I understand it, that pretty much is the bottom line. And I'm sure that's the kind of thing that when you say that, and I know you talk about this, I'm sure it gets people's attention when you start out and say, well, you know, whether you believe in it or not, that almost doesn't matter if what you're really focused on is running a business and making money. That if you're in that kind of position, then thinking green makes complete sense from the perspective of the bottom line, and so maybe the other part doesn't matter.
Precisely. Assume climate change is a hoax. Frankly, don't go to Vegas on the odds of that being true. But if all you are is a profit-maximizing capitalist, you'll do just what you'd do if you were scared to death about climate change. So in a sense, the science is irrelevant. Now, I say that with all due respect to the great climate scientists who are working very hard to get the models to catch up with observed reality. It's situations like the famine now in the Horn of Africa, the drought in Texas, sorry, Rick, prayer won't do it, the Russian fires last summer, the Pakistani floods. We're seeing climate change right before our very eyes. But let's assume that the Glenn Becks of the world are correct. It's a hoax. What you would do if all you care about is lining your pocket with more green, as in dollars, is just what you would do to solve this crisis, because we know how to solve climate change at a profit. So let's stop arguing. That can get relegated to bar talk or to the experts. Let's just get on with solving it. If it turns out it's a hoax, we'll have made a lot of money. If it turns out it's not a hoax, we'll have made a lot of money. Oh, and we'll have solved the problem. And this is what the smartest companies are already doing. DuPont, for example, more than a decade ago, decided to put a pledge out that they were going to cut their emissions of greenhouse gases 65% below their 1990 levels by 2010. Well, they hit it by 2007. They'd cut them 67% and saved themselves $3 billion between 2000 and 2005. They went on to the point that by 2007 they were saving $2.2 billion a year and driving up their stock value. They were doing this through basic good housekeeping, the sort of thing that any smart business will do. And if you read any of the business press now, you'll see businesses announcing they're putting solar panels on their roof. L'Oreal announced this last week. They're doing complete retrofits of their operations to cut out waste. The ad that was just on your station about the Subaru plant. Many of the Japanese companies have pledged to be zero waste. Walmart. Why is Walmart going green? Trust me, it's not out of the goodness of their heart. They're doing it because they're saving money.
This, and I'm sure that we'll talk some more about this, moving through the steps from the point where maybe the easiest thing is simply by looking at waste and cutting waste that allows you to save money. That means more profit. There are a number of other steps we could go through, but I keep coming back to the idea that when the discussion comes up about global climate and how it can be addressed or what we should be doing to address it, that there are people who make this argument that says, well, we can't do that because doing those things like signing on to the Kyoto Protocol, for example, would be devastating to the American economy. I mean, how is it that there are so many people who say that actually you're saying that taking these steps would be good for the economy, but on the other side, there are people who say, no, but doing this it would be a disaster for the economy?
Well, we live in the age of the big lie, where people simply put forth opinion as if it were fact without backing it up. And what we try to do in the book is supply the facts of what the companies that are implementing climate protection are achieving. For example, ST Microelectronics, another company that was early into this game, they pledged to be carbon neutral, zero net CO2 emissions by 2010. Their CEO, Pasquale Pistorio, at the time, said right up front, I have no earthly idea how to achieve this, but go and do it. Figuring it out drove their corporate innovation, took the company from the number 12 chip maker in the world to the number 6. So they're gaining market share. They reckon by the time they're done, they'd have saved about $1 billion. Some of the savings are just so in front of our face that we don't even think about it. For example, my team here at Natural Capitalism Solutions walked into a company, had 6,300 computers and monitors that they left on all year round, 24/7. Just in that company, publishing a policy, turn the darn things off if you're not sitting in front of them, would save them $700,000 a year. And last year, Ford Motor Company figured this out, published such a policy, saved themselves $1 million just by turning off computers that had nobody sitting in front of them. This is pure waste, and it is the first thing that any company ought to do, just as basic good business practices. Now, why hasn't this happened? Because managers say energy is a small part of my cost of doing business. That may be true, but the savings that you achieve on it give you a higher return on interest, return on investment, than any other investment that you would make throughout the entire economy. So it's something that you ought to be doing, just as basic good business. We worked with a little company out in California, Mi Rancho Tortillas. Their COO, Joe Santana, had no particular interest in sustainability, but he wanted to sell to Walmart. Walmart, as you may know, has come out with its sustainability scorecard. Question number one, do you measure your carbon footprint? Question number two, do you report it to the Carbon Disclosure Project? This is a little group in the United Kingdom that is now receiving reports of carbon footprints from essentially all the major companies around the world. So Joe said, what do I have to do? We helped Joe using a web-based learning tool that we have for small businesses called Solutions at the Speed of Business that helps a company on its own without having to hire pricey consultants figure out what its carbon footprint is and figure out ways of reducing it. In Joe's case, we helped him get slightly more efficient ovens to bake his tortillas, helped him do a lighting retrofit. Joe's going to save $450,000 over the next couple of years. You better believe he is now a big fan of sustainability. And these are the sorts of measures that our country ought to be investing in on Main Street. If we had taken all that darn TARP money and put it into Main Street as opposed to Wall Street, we would not now be re-entering a recession. We would have grown our way out of the recession, created jobs, millions of jobs in this emerging clean tech industry, clean economy that is, frankly, the only future that this country has. We cannot drill our way out. If we persist in believing that we can fuel our economy on oil, gas, coal, we will bankrupt the country even further. We're now borrowing $1 billion a day to buy imported oil. We're borrowing the money from the Chinese and the sovereign wealth funds of the Middle East to buy oil from the sovereign wealth funds of the Middle East in competition with the Chinese. This is just daft. This is bad economics. Now, notice, nothing in what I've said has anything to do about saving polar bears or environmentalism. This is just good business. And I'm a professor of business at Bainbridge Graduate Institute. This is what I teach my students, that, hey, guys, we know how to solve essentially all of the problems facing the planet if we just do business in a smart way.
Yeah. The two of the examples that you gave, the one where you said, where the company said, well, if you're not using your computer, turn it off. So when you go home at night, you turn it off rather than leave it on as so many people think that you should. In that particular case, that cost you nothing.
Exactly.
Now, then there's the other example is, well, if you may, like the man that you talked about who had to invest in, well, he had to buy some new ovens, and he was going to retrofit the lighting. So that actually does mean some upfront money, which the hope is eventually that gets paid back. I wonder in how many cases there are things that companies can do that can result in significant savings that actually cost them nothing, as opposed to those things where there does have to be some initial investment right up front.
Gary Hirschberg, the CEO of Stonyfield, the yogurt company, says that our venture capitalist is our efficiency program. By implementing the free measures, then the very low-cost measures, they take the savings stream that they thereby achieve and use that to capitalize successively more expensive retrofit measures. And if you do this throughout the economy, it would be better business to save at least half the energy that our country now uses, with paybacks vastly better than the return that you will get from putting money in the stock market or in a bank account. We get payback. People say, well, I need an 18-month payback before I'm going to invest anything. That's a 72% return on investment. You would not demand that of any other action in the economy. And yet we say, oh, we have to have a very rapid payback for any energy efficiency measure. Now, there are smart ways that communities can get around this hurdle. In Sonoma County out in California, the county government put in place what's called PACE financing, Property Assessed Clean Energy, where the county floated a bond, has a pool of money. Businesses and citizens can now come and get money to implement energy efficiency and put solar on their facilities. When Sonoma did this in the first 9 months of the program, construction trades in Sonoma County went up 8.4%, and this is from January to September of 2009, right in the teeth of the recession. In neighboring Napa County, which did not have this program, construction trades went down 3%. So if we want jobs, if we want to deliver money into our communities, we know how to do it. Oh, and then those paragons of financial rectitude, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, essentially banned PACE financing. Now there has been a bill introduced in the House of Representatives to ban Fannie and Freddie from interfering with PACE financing. Communities all across the country were set to do it when these idiots in the mortgage industry said, you can't put any obligation on property that could anyway be superior to ours. So what we have is a failure of policy, we have a failure of business people to do basic math, and a failure of our national will. I think it's a matter of our choice. Do we wish to become, in effect, Uganda with bombs, a debtor nation, a third world country, a resource colony, which is what we are now? Our timber, our minerals, our oil is headed for China, because China has all our money. They've been loaning us money and racking up the interest rates. And this whole kerfuffle in Washington, well, are we just going to default on everything? The United States is at a fairly tenuous point right now, and yet we know how to reverse it. Invest in this new energy economy. Invest in our own workforce. We now have more solar workers in the United States than we have steel workers, which is a good thing. And these are the industries that we should be investing in, not Wall Street, not the banks.
Our guest in this hour, Hunter Lovensay, somebody who is quite well known for writing about, speaking about the issue of sustainable development. She's founder, president of Natural Capitalism Incorporated and Natural Capitalism Solutions. She's co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute. She led that for 20 years, and she's the co-author of a newly published book. The title is Climate Capitalism, Capitalism in the Age of Climate Change. Hill and Wang is the publisher. If you'd like to call in, we'd be happy to have your comments, questions, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We also have email, will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to continue with renewable, the subject of renewable energy, and I think some people really have made the argument for that, not only because of its climate impact, but also because of issues of supply and demand, that we simply cannot continue to rely on fossil fuels to the extent that we have. And so that's why it makes so much sense to look at solar, for example, or wind or some other things, both for the energy that they generate and also the jobs that they create. Can you talk a little bit more about what you think the potential for renewables are on both of those counts?
Well, the potential for renewables is almost unlimited. The amount of sun falling on the earth could power all of our needs if we just capture it. The amount of wind flowing, for example, through the Great Plains in the Dakotas would power the country. Now, obviously, we don't want to do it that way. It's interesting. The utilities love big, capital-intensive, centralized power plants. And so we're trying to remake solar and wind and the other renewables in the image of coal and nuclear. It's much better to stick it on your own roof. I recently put a 5-kilowatt solar system on my ranch. It's oversized so that it will now power the electric cars that are now beginning to enter the market. And within a year or so, I will be free of having to buy oil, of having to buy electricity from the grid. My particular utility is very coal intensive. Yours are as well. And my cost will come down. I did this through a PACE financing mechanism here in Boulder County before it was revoked. And these are the sorts of investments in our communities. First of all, what I did was fix up my house, bring people in to do extra insulation, weatherization, so that the home needed less energy to start with. And as a result, it's more comfortable. I will be making money on my investment and will not particularly worry if the world is headed to peak oil. Actually, the International Energy Agency said the world hit peak oil in 2006. This is a somewhat scary prospect. No one quite knows if it's true. This was a theory put forth in the 1950s by the shell oil geologist M. King Hubbard, who said that if you have a finite resource, and it's a corollary of the round earth theory that oil is finite, and you have exponentially growing demand in use of the resource, half the oil used by humanity's been since the mid-90s, all of it since the 90% of it since the early 80s, we have skyrocketing demand, particularly with China and India coming into the world oil market. So we have exponentially growing demand and a finite resource. Hubbard said you fall off the production curve as steeply as you went up when you have extracted half the resource. That would mean there is still a lot of oil in the ground. What's gone is our ability to produce it at a cheap, affordable price point. And this is why 2008 oil hit 150 a barrel, well, 149 and change, and 6 months later the economy went off a cliff. You may remember that a few months ago oil hit 120 a barrel, and here we are with the economy going off a cliff again. These things are related. If we want to get off of this nasty merry-go-round, we need dramatically more efficient vehicles. These things are cheaper for you to drive. You may have noticed in the last month or so the auto companies all said, oh, yeah, we can make 50-some a gallon cars. We know they can. Ford Motor Company is selling 62-mile-a-gallon sedans in Europe right now. Volkswagen has built them that get well over 100, prototypes getting 200. And, of course, you can go to electrics, you can go to hybrids, and then we can stop worrying about what the folk in the Middle East are doing, unless we care about doing genuine development in those countries. But you better believe if Iraq grew broccoli, we would not have had troops in there. It happens to be the world's second largest reserves of oil. Now, the IEA makes interesting reading. Until 2007, it was great bedtime reading. It would put you right to sleep. I'm sure you all use that as your sleep aid. But in 2007, an IEA report warned that because of some idiosyncrasies in the Middle East, expect shortages in the supply of oil within a few years. And then, indeed, oil hit 150 a barrel. The IEA has again been coming out with these reports of late that the world has already passed peak oil, that within a few years, oil extraction will plateau and begin a steady decline. This came because a couple of whistleblowers who had been at the IEA had a report in the UK Guardian 2009 saying that the IEA had been cooking its books. The British government said, say what? We base our national projections on IEA numbers. Where'd those numbers come from? Dr. Fatih Birol, chief economist of the IEA, said, well, they're assumptions, but we'll do a real study. The study issued in December of 2009 saying, yes, well, within a few years, expect oil extraction to plateau. The Brits said, the heck you say, and came out with an industry task force chaired by the managing director of Royal Dutch Shell, whose report issued March of 2010 calling for an immediate transition to green transport as a matter of British national security. These figures are not widely reported in the United States, which is dramatically more reliant on imported oil and whose economy would be hit much harder by these kinds of price run-ups. So if you want, again, if you want a recovery, if you want economic security, if you want money in our pockets, let's innovate our way out of this problem. This is what Americans have always done. I've driven the electric. They are extraordinarily peppy. The Tesla, for example, will put coffee all over your front if you are holding a cup of coffee and accelerate that thing. It's a high-performance car. We can put the same kind of performance, and indeed Tesla is now setting out to do this, into ordinary passenger vehicles. We have all of the technology that we need. Most of it was developed in the United States, and yet we're allowing it to go to China, to Europe, because we're not investing in it as a nation.
Well, we have a couple of callers here to bring in. Let's do that. Somebody start out here on a cell phone here in Champaign County. Let's go there. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'd like to make a couple of comments. One, to carry on some with Ford thing. I remember decades ago, Ford in what then was their newest facility proudly showing off that the roof had a lawn on it and actually was a park, and that was part of their green technology, and Bill Ford announcing Ford's plan at that time to be, you know, an economically considerate company. And I believe that with the recent bailouts, that Ford was the only auto manufacturer in this country that didn't need a government bailout. And, you know, I don't know that that was a coincidence. And I also remember when I was taking business classes in college, one of the things that was hammered over and over again is that every dollar in savings drops whole and intact to the bottom line. Every dollar of savings adds $1 to the profit margin, whereas every dollar that is gained through a new customer, and this was some years ago, and I'm sure it's smaller now, but every dollar that was gained through acquiring a new customer probably added a dime to the bottom line. And so, you know, obviously the best way for a company, an organization, to increase its profits is to cut its costs. And if you can do that by going green, then, yeah, I certainly agree with the guest.
Well,
your caller is spot on. In both instances, Ford was the only American auto company that did not need a bailout. They went to the banks in the ordinary way that the good business does business, borrowed the money they needed. Ford has been investing heavily in electrics, in hybrids. The U.S. auto industry was fat and happy, sitting behind its lobbyists, content that Congress would never force them to change while the Japanese innovated. And as a result, in the first couple of oil shocks, the Japanese swept the market. Toyota became the world's largest car company. Toyota then lost its way, thinking that, oh, well, if the demand is for great big trucks, that's what we'll build. And as a result, let quality control slip on its flagship Prius. Toyota lost being the world's largest car company when that happened. It went over to Volkswagen. Toyota has now reclaimed it and has said, we get it, we're now in the business of fuel efficiency. Ford was one of the first to recognize this, although GM is now right behind them and has exited bankruptcy. The smart companies in this next decade will be those who understand that the best business is efficiency, the second best business is delivering products that are renewably powered, products that are sustainably made, products that are made without excess waste, because this is the best for their pocketbook, it's also the best for their customers.
All right, let's talk with another caller here, Champaign County. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. I don't have your broad confidence in capitalism per se. It's a broader discussion. I don't think it has existed here for a while. We have a corporatocracy that's captured the state so that things that aren't economically reasonable to do are defined that way as reasonable. Externalities, you pointed out, you know, security for our oil under the Middle East is an expense that the oil companies don't have to pay. It's externalized to the polity, broader us as a taxpayer, and as long as the state, I mean, I don't object to the state having a more active role in the economy personally. I think, what I see is that as long as it's captured by corporate power, who want the centralized power plants that you were talking about earlier, I think we need a broader critique, basically. And I do applaud the Rocky Mountain Institute and their analysis about nuclear power, which is a government intervention. I mean, it would never have gone ahead at all without Price-Anderson Act and restrained liability and that sort of thing. So I don't know how you want to respond to that, but it just seems to me that it's all well and good to say Walmart's, you know, putting in sun tubes and going green because it's good for their economic line, but as long as they're still buying, you know, all the product from China that is, you know, powered mainly by carbon plants, and the broader kind of things that are going on in the world, it seems, particularly with the crisis that we're having, it seems like we need a more radical solution, I would think.
You might enjoy checking out Chapter 10 of the book, in which we say, you know, all kidding aside, climate change is very real. It's a very serious problem. It's upon us. And if we had a free market, it might solve it by itself in time. But as you rightly point out, we don't. The International Energy Agency came out with a release earlier this year that around the world we subsidize the use of fossil energy to the tune of $550 billion a year. And this doesn't even count the subsidies in the United States and in Europe. So the clean technologies are swimming upstream against a, as you rightly say, a corporatocracy, or perhaps even now a kleptocracy with folk like the Koch brothers of Valero and Tesoro Oil, putting money into electoral campaigns. Although it was very pleasing in California, they put millions of dollars into trying to overturn California's effort to have a carbon market and failed. California voters saw through it, voted them down, and California's market is continuing on. Now, you mentioned Walmart. You're quite right. I spoke to the senior management at Walmart shortly after they began this whole effort and said, fair enough, you're putting solar panels on your roof and selling organic underwear. But if you roam the planet rapaciously, exploiting people in developing countries and in communities here so that people like me can throw away more junk, this is not sustainable. What would a truly sustainable Walmart business model be? And the answer to that may be gone. But at the same time, the Walmarts of the world exist. They're here. They're a major player. And the work that we do at Natural Capitalism Solutions is to try to help these companies be a force for positive change in the world. If you'd asked me 6 years ago who I thought would be the biggest entity on the planet pushing for sustainability, I'd have offered to eat my hat if you'd have said Walmart. But I think it's true. When Walmart came out with its sustainability scorecard, 15 questions that it is seeking to push four levels deep in its supply chain. Questions about resource use and water use and impact on communities. Walmart is doing more than I am to push sustainability into companies, countries. Walmart's impact on China is vastly larger than any I could have. And when Walmart starts saying to its Chinese suppliers, you will have efficient factories, you will start cutting your carbon emissions, that had a hand in China's insistence now on moving to a green economy. Yes, China is one of the world's largest burners of coal. They're now the world's largest emitter of carbon, although on a per capita basis, the United States is far ahead of them. But the Chinese are moving with warp speed to implement energy efficiency, to implement renewable energy. The town of Rizhao, China, 3 million people, 99% have solar hot water. How many of you do? And that's why. The Chinese realize if they can get production volumes up, they can get per unit cost down and export. They are looking to the United States as an export market for their solar hot water. Baoding, China, the young mayor woke up one morning to find that the lake that the city surrounded had died. The industrial toxins from their legacy industries, car and textile, had killed all the fish. He said, polluting first and cleaning up later is very costly. We're going green. And started recruiting renewable energy companies to come and locate in Baoding. It's now called China's Electronic Valley. It is the center of prosperity for that region in China. We can learn from what China is doing and, again, begin recruiting renewable energy companies into our communities because we create the investment climate in those communities where they can sell their product. Contrast with that Evergreen Solar, which was recruited to Massachusetts with lots of subsidies, and then moved to China because the Chinese subsidies were even more attractive. We've got to ensure that these industries of this next industrial revolution have a good home here in the United States, because these are the jobs that we want our people to have. This is the basis of the economy that we want to have. In Chapter 10, we look at what it will take to design a future that works. And if you look at our economic system now, if the GDP goes up, we all go, oh, that's very good. Is it? What is GDP? Gross national product. It is the flow through the economy of money and stuff. If a divorcing cancer patient gets in a car wreck, she has added to the gross national product. Is she any better off? Clearly not. What is it that we truly want more of in our economy? And does the economy exist to serve us, to enhance human well-being, or do we as consumers exist to run the economy? It's rather become the latter in the last few years. What did our president say after 9/11? Go shopping. Is this really the life that we all want?
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Hunter Lovins. She's well known around the world for writing about sustainable development, and we're talking about some of the ideas you will find in the book that she's co-authored. The title of the book is Climate Capitalism. We'll have more after a very short break. This is Focus.
This month, maintenance work is being performed on our AM580 antenna. It'll make our signal more reliable, especially during inclement weather. At times when the work is in progress, we'll need to reduce our power, and some of you may have trouble receiving AM580 as clearly as usual. 90.9 FM will not be affected, and AM580 is always available online at will.illinois.edu. Thanks for understanding.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Kennedy's Restaurant, next to the Stone Creek Golf Course in Urbana, featuring a wide array of certified Angus beef steaks and burgers and seafood entrees. Reservations can be made at 384-8111.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and 10 different topics every week. You can look at the schedule, find out what we'll be doing in the days ahead by going to willl.illinois.edu. In this hour, Hunter Lovins is our guest. We're talking about some of what you'll find in her recent book, Climate Capitalism, Capitalism in the Age of Climate Change. It's published by Hill and Wang, in which it makes the argument that whether you're concerned with climate change or not, and whether you believe that it's real or not, if what you're interested in is making money, if you're in business and you're interested in making money, if you're interested in having a robust economy, you would behave as if you thought it was a big problem. She has done consulting work with a number of companies and businesses, big and small, to help them look at how it is they use energy to be more efficient, to take advantage of these opportunities, and says that again and again, what you see is that it affects positively the bottom line of these companies. So if you have questions, you can call us. We have a couple of people ready to go, and we'll try to get everybody in. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next is Urbana in line one. Hello.
Hello. I calculate that the federal government is borrowing $1.75 billion a day. That's 40 cents on every dollar of a trillion and a half. You know what I'm saying, yearly budget. But my main point is Robert Kennedy Jr. certainly confirms what your guest is saying. Give a few quotes of his speeches. Coal companies avoid serious legal consequences for their crimes by subverting democracy, corrupting elected officials, buying judgeships, capturing the regulatory agencies, and muzzling public officials. He's talking about West Virginia, and he says West Virginia is a rogue state that allows the private interests of the mining industries to trump federal law and the fundamental ownership by the American people of the nation's air and water. The villain in this piece is Massey Coal. And let's see, there's one more quote. Oh, yeah, they filled The coal industry has spilled 2,500 miles of stream with no legal consequences. They've blown up 500 mountains in the last 10 years. They flattened an area the size of Delaware, and all that area is now a non-functioning ecosystem.
Well, your caller is quite right. Mountaintop removal is one of the great tragedies, human tragedies, cultural tragedies, environmental tragedies of our time. There are a number of groups, Appalachian Voices and others, that are working to try to reverse this. Dr. David Orr, Dr. John Todd are working in Appalachia to bring clean energy to the communities and transform the economy of Appalachia. I know a little about this. My mother's side of the family comes from West Virginia. My grandfather was a coal mine operator. My mother helped organize with John L. Lewis in the coal fields. And this is a long and bloody battle that has raged the better part of a century. It's time to put an end to the stranglehold of fossil fuel on our lives and on our economy. And again, make the transition to clean energy. I was recently with Ray Mabus, Secretary of the Navy, who said, you know, Navy ships used to run on coal. And when we switched to oil, the folk who ran the Navy infrastructure for coal said, oh, this is going to be a terrible transition, but we made it. He said, it is now time to transition to renewable energy as a matter of national security. The Navy's already flown an F-15 on biofuel made from algae. They call it the Green Hornet. We have forward operating bases in Afghanistan that are 100% renewably powered. Why? Because for every 24 convoys of trucks coming over from Pakistan, a Marine goes home in a body bag. Most of what those convoys are hauling is oil, diesel, to run the military bases that can be run even better on renewable energy. So it's interesting that as Walmart is helping to lead the way, so is the U.S. military. It's time to do the same thing in our communities, again as a matter of national security.
All right, let's go to another caller here, Belgium, line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. As Mr. Inge knows, I am a very strong advocate of hydrogen, and it is something that has just totally dropped off the picture. There was some talk of a fellow out in Silicon Valley made the Bloom Box, which it converted not just hydrogen, but just any kind of feed source that had hydrogen in it to produce electricity much cheaper. And some of the Silicon Valley companies out there even incorporated it as their power sources. So it must have been fairly stable and good power source, or they wouldn't do it because their industry requires a very strong and solid electrical system. It seems that, as you've been speaking, people who have a great deal of energy interest in the energy systems that we use today keep forcing us away from probably the wiser decisions, because hydrogen not only has a way to be clean, but it generates us a whole new infrastructure that we could make a lot of money off of. And other countries in this world seem to be trying to move in that direction. Can you discuss that, please?
Sure. Hydrogen is a very interesting energy carrier. It's not a fuel in and of itself. It's the most abundant element in the universe, except perhaps for stupidity. But hydrogen does not come in a concentrated form. And so it takes energy to get hydrogen, which you then feed into a fuel cell like the Bloom Box. Another problem with the fuel cells is they have to be handmade at this point. Now, I'm technology neutral. I actually don't care which technology we use as long as we do honest accounting so that we look at the actual cost, the full cost accounting for any particular technology. Far and away, the cheapest is efficiency. Then you get to the various renewables. Unfortunately, right now, hydrogen fed into fuel cells is one of the more expensive. My ex-husband, Amory Lovins, and I disagree on this. He's a huge hydrogen fan. I think hydrogen will be trumped by some of the other technologies, except in special uses. But the real problem is, how do you concentrate the hydrogen? Right now, what we do is steam reform natural gas, to make the hydrogen. You're still using natural gas, and it takes quite a lot of energy to get the hydrogen out. You can get hydrogen by splitting water, using the sun. Some algaes produce hydrogen as they grow, and there's some interesting lab-scale technology to concentrate hydrogen in that route. But until you have a way of producing very cheap hydrogen, the fuel cell technology will probably remain on the shelf. The reason the Bloombox is doing fairly well is that they can feed natural gas into it. But on the other hand, if really all you're doing is using natural gas, then microturbines are an even more advanced and stable technology. The reason a lot of these companies are investing in it is, one, they get tax credits. Two, they're interested in innovative technology. And as a result, some of the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, are looking very closely at the Bloombox. But I suspect in the end, what we're going to have is a diversified grid based largely on solar photovoltaic, and there's some very, very innovative new photovoltaic technologies coming aboard, wind in appropriate sites, a little bit of hydro, and some really interesting new technologies that are just starting to enter the market. For example, biofuels from biochar. When you heat woody material at low temperature, you get a char which, when you put it into the ground, is an amazing soil amendment. You know, we all ought to be putting it into our gardens to increase fertility. It ought to be being put into big farming to increase fertility, and in many places it is. There's a company called Ecotechnologies that is producing this biochar. You also get out of it an oil which can be used as the feedstock for making plastic or for making fuel. And done in a sustainable fashion, based on sustainable agriculture, this, I think, will be a huge contributor. Dr. Tim Flannery, the scientist from Australia, said biochar may be the technology that saves humanity. So take a good look at biochar. I suspect that these kinds of technologies will beat hydrogen. On the other hand, our entrepreneurs aren't done innovating. And again, this is what I think as a country we ought to be investing in, is all of these cutting-edge technologies. Let them then play out in a real market or a regulated market that favors the technologies that come in at least cost with the fewest side effects. And we can power our nation very handily just on renewable energy.
Okay. Well, again, I want to thank the caller and continue. We have a few more people, and we're getting pretty tight on time here, so I'd like to try to get in as many as we can. We've got about 5 minutes left in the show, so next person is in Edgar County, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm very happy to hear your comments, Dr. Hunter. I would like to say that when we're talking about ecology and conservation, whatever line you want to put on it, and I've been involved with this since 1970 in Central Park, I would say that we have a thin green line that we proclaim about going green, and yet somehow the trickle-down theory doesn't quite hit the populace. And it's just like a simple thing like our plastic bags at grocery stores, trying to get the people in the grocery store to ask if you have reusable bags before they start stuffing your things into plastic bags, it gets a little old. And, you know, I have, you know, gone all the way to the corporate level on the fact they sell you the bag doesn't last terribly long, and you have to buy a new one, so the renewable thing is kind of done in. So, you know, education is important, and I don't know what happened there. I thought all the schools were teaching, you know, green methods and such, but it doesn't seem to be working. Do you have any comment?
Sure. We need to reform education just as we need to reform our economy. A group of us are working on what we call the Madrone Project to take sustainability education digital using tablets, the sorts of technologies that young people are using, and curating this material so that it is designed for the digital age, so that it's short, punchy, entertaining, and will capture the imagination of young people. You can check us out online, themadroneproject.com. We can use market mechanisms. A number of jurisdictions are outright banning plastic bags. Some of them just start charging for them. If you charge enough for a plastic bag, people are going to remember to bring their canvas bags. The canvas bags I use to shop with, I've had for 20 years. They last just fine. So if you're going to invest in a reusable bag, just be sure you invest in a good one. But you're quite right. We're going to have to transform education.
We're just to the point here where we're going to have to finish. My apologies. We have a couple of people we can't take. Just real quick, is there some thoughts you'd like to leave folks with?
Sure. Whatever it is that you have in front of you that you think you can do today to be a part of this new clean economy, just start doing it. Great example is General Electric that in 2005 announced Ecomagination. All they did was badges green products they were already making. Within 2 years, however, those green-badged products had doubled in sales volume. Last year, the CEO, Jeff Immelt, put a letter out to shareholders saying that if Ecomagination were a separate company, it would be a Fortune 130, and its revenue growth twice that of the rest of the company. What started as hypocrisy has turned into GE's premier line. So just start. Look at your life, look at what you can do, and start doing something to be a part of the solution.
If you're interested in looking at some of the things that we have talked about, some of the things that Hunter Lovins is involved in, the Madrone Project, Natural Capitalism Incorporated, Natural Capitalism Solutions, they all have websites, and you can also read some of the ideas that we have talked about here in her book, Climate Capitalism, Capitalism in the Age of Climate Change. That's a subtitle published by Hill and Wang. And Hunter Lovins, thanks very much for talking with us today.
David, thanks for having me on.